The Supreme Court nears the end of a historic term in which several important rulings impacting religion are being decided. This week, taxpayer funds for religious schools and the big one that had the country holding its breath, the Dobbs abortion case out of Mississippi. A victory for life at the Supreme Court as justices rule in favor of the 2018 Mississippi law restricting most abortions after 15 weeks in the case known as Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. In a vote of 5-4 authored by Justice Samuel Alito, the High Court overturned the right to abortion established nearly 50 years ago. Alito arguing that Roe versus Wade was, quote, egregiously wrong from the start. As we said, the case challenged the landmark abortion case Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion nationwide in 1973, and also Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which set up the framework for viability. Abortion legalization now goes to the states. According to the Catholic News Agency, more than a dozen states have trigger laws, some of which immediately outlaw abortion now that the case has ruled in favor of Mississippi. Those states are highlighted on this map, including Alabama, Kentucky, Louisiana, South Dakota, Idaho, Tennessee, Texas, Arkansas, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Oklahoma, Utah, and Wyoming. Some states have moved in the other direction, protecting abortion. Joining us to discuss this blockbuster ruling, Mark Rienzi, president of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and professor of constitutional law at the Catholic University of America. Mark, thank you so much for joining us on this day. I'm sure you haven't even had time to finish reading the more than 200-page decision, but it's a good day for life for all of us. Thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch just released this statement saying in part, now our work to empower women and promote life truly begins. The court has let loose its hold on abortion policymaking and given it back to the people. Mark, this 5-4 decision, what does it really mean?
Yeah, and in some ways I might even say it's a 6-3 or a 5-1-3. Because Chief Justice Roberts does agree with the majority for much of the ruling. So what it means is that the court has decided that there is no secret, unspoken constitutional right to an abortion. What the court says is, look, the Constitution just didn't resolve and didn't create a federal constitutional right to kill unborn children. Instead, the court says that issue is left to the states. And so the people can use the democratic process to decide how they want to deal with these very difficult issues instead of having the Constitution dictate the one-size-fits-all answer that there must be a right to do it.
And over the past couple of months, we've seen states take this up and start to pass some laws and propose some laws that would respond to today's decision, effectively using the democratic process. But the country has been divided enough on abortion that it never passed a legislative or a congressional right to abortion to enshrine it that way. Is the court then reflecting that by leaving it to the states?
Yeah, I think the court is reflecting what is, you know, I think really the only honest reading of the Constitution, which is the Constitution is a short document and it addresses some things, but there's many things it doesn't address. And it plainly doesn't tell us what the answer is to the question of abortion. So what the court says is, look, it was wrong and it was a mistake and it was bad for the law and bad for the country to pretend that the Constitution resolved that. And we're going to fix the mistake we made. And we're going to say the Constitution doesn't do it. And therefore, the Constitution leaves it to the people like it leaves so many other things to the people. And the democratic process, as you say, is how we sort things out. And the truth is, for a couple generations now, we haven't had the practice of using the democratic process to sort this out. It's all been sort of, you know, stifled and controlled by the Supreme Court's decision without letting people get used to the idea of working out these hard questions in the democratic process. But now people are going to get used to that again, and it's a good thing.
And there's going to be a lot for us to cover. Mark, I neglected to mention that you and I work together at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. It's important for our viewers to know that. But your career has largely focused on protecting free speech rights of pro-lifers. You talk about this at Catholic University in part of your constitutional law courses. And you won a Supreme Court victory protecting the free speech right of pro-lifers. Why is that freedom so much more important today, now that this issue is at the state level?
Yeah, well, you know, the freedom to talk about, to think about, to have your own religious beliefs about, and to try to convince others about these issues has always been important. And again, is really more important today because people today can now go to the ballot box and they can vote for officials and people can vote on laws to regulate abortion and protect the unborn and do what they think is right. And so for a long time, we could talk about it all we wanted. but the only two places it could get resolved was the sidewalk in front of an abortion clinic or the nine justices at the Supreme Court. And now the court has said, no, the Constitution didn't answer that question. We're going to let the people resolve it through the democratic process. And we don't know exactly how that'll turn out. And in some places, they will have laws that are very, very favorable to abortion, and many, many babies will still die. In some places, they'll have laws that are much more protective of life. I certainly hope we see more and more of the ones protecting life. In this country, we really ought to be able to welcome welcome babies into this world and find ways to support them and support mothers. So hopefully that's the future that we get after this decision.
Thank you so much, Mark. And we'll be tracking that future here on EWTN News In Depth. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
We'll have more in-depth coverage of this historic decision next Friday with a panel of more legal experts. In another important case for the faithful, we got a decision in Carson versus Macon affecting school choice and the use of taxpayer funds to pay for religious education, a 6-3 conservative majority ruling in favor of parents who sued the state of Maine. In rural parts of Maine, not all public school districts have high schools, so the state offers tuition assistance to parents, allowing their children to attend private schools. Parents can use the tuition assistance to send their children to private schools outside of Maine and even outside the country. But before this case, they couldn't use the funds to send their children to a religious school. Two sets of parents brought this exception to the Supreme Court, alleging the exclusion of religious private schools from the funding was discrimination and an infringement on their First Amendment rights. Alana Stevenson, principal of St. Dominic Academy in Auburn, Maine, told EWTN News In Depth in December that it's hard to turn down families who want to attend her Catholic school.
There are a number of reasons why students and families would choose St. Dom's over other schools, and to have to say no or to not be able to help support those people and those kids is a really hard decision.
Leading up to this decision were two other Supreme Court cases, both victories for the religious plaintiffs, one out of Missouri and another from Montana. Both cases claimed religious schools should be allowed to participate in state government funding programs. The court reached the same conclusion this week in Carson as it did in those cases. Chief Justice John Roberts' opinion says Maine's non-sectarian requirement for tuition assistance payments violates the First Amendment. He writes, a state's anti-establishment interest does not justify enactments that exclude some members from the community from an otherwise generally available public benefit because of their religious exercise. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in her dissent, said the court continues to dismantle the wall of separation between church and state that the framers fought to build and leads us to a place where separation of church and state becomes a constitutional violation. Here to discuss the court's decision and the relationship between private religious schools and the government is the lead counsel for the plaintiffs in the Carson case, Michael Bindis, senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. Congratulations, Michael, on this really important victory and a hard-earned one, one that you've been working on for a long time.
Thank you very much. Yeah, this is a fight actually 3 decades in the making. We've been trying to get at this issue up to the Supreme Court for a long time, and Tuesday of this week was certainly a wonderful day.
And you've been at the lead of it. So before we get into the meat of this important decision, let's dig into that background of the case. After the famous Playground Missouri tire scraps recycling program and then the Montana voucher cases a few years ago, many thought that the funding of religious private schools issue was settled. What was still left to clarify?
Well, yeah, you're right. One would have thought it was settled. However, that wasn't clear to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. Back in 2018, we challenged this exclusion in Maine's town tuitioning program. While we were litigating the case, that Espinoza decision that you referenced came out and said that government cannot exclude religious schools from a school choice program. We thought that that should have resolved this case as well, the main case. But the First Circuit said, this is different. In Montana, government was excluding schools simply because they were religious, because of their religious status. In Maine, however, government is excluding them because of the religious things that they do, like teach religion. And in the First Circuit's view, this was somehow a constitutionally meaningful distinction. We obviously did not think so. And on Tuesday, the court said there was no such distinction.
It's fantastic. So then how far did this decision go? Is there still much more work to do for religious liberty groups and school choice groups to have parity alongside secular institutions?
You know, I think this this decision fully and finally resolves what has been the last kind of major constitutional question lingering over school choice. Back in 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court held that it's perfectly permissible under the state constitution to have a school choice program that includes religious options. But in the two decades since that decision, school choice opponents have been insisting that even if it's permissible under the federal constitution, it's still impermissible under state constitutions and state statutes that require that no public funds flow to religious schools. After this decision on Tuesday, they can no longer rely on those state laws to either try to convince legislators not to adopt these programs or to attack them once they are adopted. The Supreme Court has now made fully clear that a citizen cannot be excluded from a school choice program or some other public benefit program simply because they wish to exercise their right, in this case, to select a religious school for their child.
And so you spent two decades working out the details of that right. Do your clients get to attend the religious school of their choice this fall?
So our lead client in the case graduated last year as this case was up at the Supreme Court. But our other, so no, she's off in college now and doing wonderfully. But for our other client, and just as importantly, for every parent in the state that has a child participating in this program, they will now be able to use it this fall to attend a religious school if they believe that that's the best fit for their child.
That's good to hear. One last question. Rachel Laser, the president and CEO of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, which joined the Friend of the Court brief supporting the state of Maine and their program, criticized the ruling, saying that the Supreme Court is forcing taxpayers to fund religious education. Is this true?
It's not true at all. This program, like all school choice programs, operates on private choice. Government isn't funding schools, whether religious or not. It's funding families and allowing them to decide where to use this tuition benefit. That private, independent choice of parents breaks any link between church and state, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly said as much. So this program is not about, or this decision is not about, the court forcing states to fund religion. It's saying that states cannot discriminate against citizens in the provision of a public benefit program like this school choice program.
A protection of individual rights in education. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.
What impact will this court decision have on school choice? We're joined now by Stephanie Soroki de Garcia, the co-founder and managing editor of Seton Education Partners. Her national non-for-profit works to expand educational opportunities for Catholic education in underserved communities. Stephanie, it is so great to have you here with us. First, tell us about Seton. What do you do and how does the partnership work?
Great. Seton Education Partner was founded about 12 years ago at the height of the Great Recession. And we work to create new seats for underserved children that are academically excellent, character rich, and vibrantly Catholic. We work in two geographies right now, Cincinnati and the Bronx. And we're expanding to the Rio Grande Valley, Texas, and to Paterson, New Jersey over the next 2 years.
Wow, that's a lot of work. Stephanie, then which communities benefit most from the schools and programs that you run?
Yeah, so in the Bronx, we are in the poorest congressional district in the entire country, Mott Haven. And in Cincinnati, we're in Christ Hill. And so both of these are very under-resourced neighborhoods where there are limited educational options that are of any decent quality for families.
And is that typical of Catholic education to be in the peripheries or with the underserved?
Yes, for over 200 years, Catholic schools have served, especially new immigrants, but people trying to make their way in this country, and they've done it better than any other kind of school. And unfortunately, with the reduction of religious nuns, brothers and priests, our Catholic schools in our inner cities have gone away. And so we are working to find new ways to achieve the goals of Catholic education for the poor.
And then why is a Catholic identity critical to what you do? How is the current public system leaving some children behind?
Yeah. So not only is the current public school system not serving kids well academically, too often our public schools are undermining the moral teachings that parents are trying to pass on to their children. And this is becoming especially egregious when it comes to issues of human sexuality. Starting in kindergarten in California, where I live, and in New York and in New Jersey, children are learning about the gender unicorn and are being taught that their gender was assigned at birth and that they can choose what gender they want to be. And I cannot tell you how confusing this is for the children, and what a divide it brings up between parents and their children.
Absolutely. And then what is it about the Catholic identity that makes them different? Is it a perspective on the human person, or?
It is one, it's a belief in something greater than yourself. It's an understanding that you are mind, body, and soul. It's an understanding that being and living a life of meaning and purpose and goodness is more important than the material things of this world.
And so the Carson decision hopefully was good news to you. What was your reaction? The dissents in the opinion specifically mentioned charter schools. Will this affect your programs?
I think it is just another, I don't know that it'll affect our charter schools. What it'll do is it'll protect families in Maine and Vermont right now. So the scope of impact is narrow, but look, this is a victory for parents, it's a victory for school children, and it's a victory for religious liberty. This is once again the Supreme Court saying you cannot discriminate against religion in this country. And thank God for the Supreme Court. They are righting injustices, and I cannot be more grateful.
And Stephanie, you know, we often hear contradicting narratives of schools shutting down in some archdioceses from lack of enrollment. But then COVID came in and security-driven parents who are shifting from public to private schools are countering that narrative. Who's got it right? Do we have more people in private religious schools or less people?
So this past year, we had the biggest uptick in enrollment in private, especially religious Catholic schools. That we've seen in several decades. And I think a big reason for that is our public, the parents are becoming woke to our public school system's dysfunctions. So I think it's a combination of COVID and it's things like CRT and this transgender movement that is really waking parents up.
Well, Stephanie, we're grateful for what you do, and we're hopeful that you'll continue to do your good work. Thank you so much.
Thanks. God bless.
Next, we talk Supreme Court, religious freedom, and life and dignity for all with one of our country's leading Catholic voices, His Eminence Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York. Our in-depth, on-the-record interview next. This week kicked off the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Religious Freedom Week. The observance opened on Wednesday, the feast of Saints Thomas More and John Fisher, both martyrs who fought religious persecution and government meddling in the affairs of the church. The theme this year is life and dignity for all. That relates to many areas, including the protection of the unborn, freedom of conscience for healthcare workers, freedom to safely pray after a rise in attacks on churches, and freedom of speech so that Christians can proclaim the gospel. Religious Freedom Week extends outside of the U.S., particularly China, with a call for prayers for religious minorities facing persecution there. Catholics, Christians, Buddhists, and Uyghur Muslims are all subject to discrimination limits on practicing their faith, imprisonment, forced labor, and other human rights violations. The chairman of the USCCB's Committee for Religious Liberty joins us now to share more about Religious Freedom Week. Cardinal Timothy Dolan, the Archbishop of New York, is on the record. It's so wonderful to have you here, Cardinal Dolan. A treat to be back on the program with you.
Monsi, it's always a joy to be with you. Thank you for the invitation as we commence Religious Freedom Week. And by the way, thanks for your excellent service on behalf of the Beckett Fund on the Bishop's Committee on Religious Liberty.
Thank you so much, Your Eminence. It seems each time we talk, something big is happening in education. But before we get to that, let's discuss this Religious Freedom Week initiative. Why should Catholics care about religious freedom?
Well, Catholics should care for two reasons. First of all, we're loyal, patriotic Americans. and religious freedom is at the core of all our other freedoms. It was no surprise that our founders listed the freedom of religion as first in the four freedoms in the Bill of Rights. The founders of this remarkable experiment in Ardor democracy that we call the United States of America, the founders, even though historians tell us most of them were not overtly religious men, they realized that the freedom of religion was essential to a vibrant, virtue-driven, free society. So they put it first. So as Americans, just as patriots, we Catholics stand ready to promote and defend religious freedom. But as Catholics, we kind of have a pragmatic interest, because whenever religious freedom is tampered with, we're one of the first to feel it. Because for us, like our Jewish neighbors, like our Islamic neighbors, freedom of religion means we not only have the freedom to pray it and to worship on our Sabbath, but we have the freedom, the liberty, even the duty to bring the convictions of that worship and that religion to the public square. That too is essential for a vibrant democracy. And very often, even people who pay lip service to religious freedom say, you're free to worship, but oh, be careful about bringing those convictions to the public square, because religion is private. We Catholics say, baloney. Yeah, religion is personal. It's not private. The essence of religion is to bring it beyond, to bring it out there. So both as Americans and as Catholics, we take religious freedom of the utmost importance and rejoice in the heritage of our beloved country and protecting it.
That's right. We believe in other people's religious freedom, because there's no use in waiting for the bear to eat you last. This year's theme for Religious Freedom Week involves life and religious freedom together, interwoven. We know that defending the right to life at the Supreme Court has been led by the Little Sisters of the Poor for many years. But why else was this theme, the two issues together, important?
Well, because we bishops on the Committee for Religious Freedom and our excellent consultants like you, Monsi, and so many others, felt that one of the arenas where religious liberty was most threatened is in our defense of the sacredness of human life. By the way, that's not a religious issue. That too is at the core of religious freedom and of America's constitutional destiny and makeup. But we believe that the protection of life is probably the area where religious freedom is most compromised or threatened to be compromised, particularly, Monsi. Now, we know how sometimes the executive branch of our government can intrude, how the judicial branch, how Congress can intrude. We're seeing more and more what we call bureaucratic intrusion. When bureaucrats in the federal government begin to put out laws that threaten the protection of human life and the right of conscience for our beloved healthcare workers not to violate their conscience when they're trying not to do any harm, when they're trying to serve the culture of life. That's under threat these days. And we said, hey, we're just not cerebral when it talks about the defense of religious liberty. Let's think of a particular arena where that is practically threatened. And we see that in the protection of the sacredness of human life.
Catholic and religious private schools made this big splash at the Supreme Court this week. But I'm curious what your thoughts are on the new $10 billion school choice bill, the Educational Choice for Children Act, that creates a federal tax credit program to cover expenses for K-12 education. Will this help the church and our schools?
You bet it will. To use a Catholic word, Monsi, bingo. This is extraordinarily good news. And thoughtful, wise people of any political stripe are beginning to see we need very dramatic reform in the way we educate our kids. And we need to stress kids, not where they're at school, but just kids. Wherever they're at school, we need to help them. We also need, and this is a growing movement in the United States, we also need to reassert the traditional American belief that the primary educators of our children happen to be the parents, not a state bureaucracy, not a teachers' union, okay? parents. Parents can entrust the education of their kids to a school system, and we're glad they do. That's the genius of our government school system, our entire educational system. But the parents have the right to choose. Those two ideas, parental rights and the necessity of a reform of our education, are really driving shrewd politicians to say, we got to do something. And one way to do this is through tuition tax credits. Hallelujah. Thanks be to God for the recent Supreme Court decision. Thanks be to God for more and more of our thoughtful politicians who are making sure the tuition tax credits are part of any educational reform.
So that everyone can have access to this education. There's another case, that of Coach Kennedy and his prayer at the 50-yard line, where you and your brother bishops filed a brief in his defense. What can we learn from his desire to offer his work and his victories to God?
Again, you see it, Monsi. So it's very necessary for us to remember that in America, we speak of freedom of religion and the free exercise of it. Our opponents are more than happy to give us freedom of worship. Hey, if you're superstitious enough to want to go to Mass on Sunday or the synagogue on Saturday or the mosque on Friday, if you want to waste your time doing that, we defend your freedom to do it. Just don't bring those values out to the public square. We say, our nation defends not only the right to worship, but the free exercise of that religious conviction. And this coach was exercising that in a very non-threatening way. Why in the world would we protect the right of a coach to cuss and not protect the right of a coach to pray, to offer prayer for victory or prayer and defeat? Okay, this is beautiful. Nobody was forced to do it. He was simply expressing his religious convictions in a very peaceful, uplifting way. And that was limited. So more power to him. I toast him for his victory.
We're so grateful for you, Your Eminence, and we're praying for you on this special day. God
bless
you.
Thanks, Monsi. I'm praying with and for you on this beautiful feast of the Sacred Heart of Jesus.
Amen. The USCCB has a website dedicated to Religious Freedom Week with a list of prayer intentions, downloadable graphics that you can use to promote this week on your social media channels. We'll be back in a moment with top headlines from The Week in Review.
This decision isn't just reckless, it's reprehensible.
It's not just cases involving religion that have proven controversial this term at the Supreme Court. Reaction to a decision announced Thursday about the right to bear arms in the streets. Beautiful witness to the importance of family love, a vocation and path to holiness at the World Meeting of Families. Insight from our EWTN team in Rome.
Regardless of what religion you are, it doesn't matter, you're always welcome. And hopefully we have something for you.
And the secret to their success, we'll go to Nashville, Tennessee to visit a legendary Catholic bookstore known for its appeal to Christians across denominations. That report coming up.
The Supreme Court ruling on Second Amendment rights tops The Week in Review. On Thursday, justices ruled 6-3 that New York's gun regulations making it difficult to get a concealed carry license were unconstitutional. New York's handgun licensing law requires New Yorkers to show a special need to defend themselves if they want to carry a handgun in public. New York courts required applicants to show more than a general desire to protect themselves on their property. The opinion was written by Justice Clarence Thomas. He made it clear that the Second Amendment's guarantee of the right to keep and bear arms protects a broad right to carry a handgun outside the home for self-defense. The decision is extremely controversial in light of recent shootings and is getting mixed reactions.
We cannot allow New York to become the Wild Wild West. That is unacceptable. This decision is created. We will not allow our city to live in fear that everyone around us is armed and that any altercation could evolve into a shootout.
What the statistics will bear out is that anywhere where a universal pistol permit carrying has been approved, the crime rate has gone down because the criminals are just as worried about confronting someone who has a gun as the people who are unarmed are worried about being confronted by an armed criminal.
Justice Stephen Breyer wrote an impassioned dissenting opinion referencing the nearly 300 mass shootings since January of this year, and data showing gun violence has surpassed car crashes as the leading cause of death among children and teens. And in a concurring opinion to the Thomas decision, Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote that states can still impose licensing guidelines for carrying concealed weapons, but that once a gun buyer meets those basic requirements, a state may not layer on additional discretionary rules. And on the very day the Supreme Court announced its decision in the gun case, the Senate passed legislation designed to help curb the epidemic of mass shootings. Passage of the measure by a 65-33 vote marked the first significant federal gun legislation in 30 years. The bipartisan package focuses on keeping guns away from dangerous potential killers and pumps billions of dollars into mental health services and school security initiatives.
This will become the most significant piece of anti-gun violence legislation Congress has passed in three decades. And as a result, this bill also has the chance to prove to a weary American public that democracy is not so broken that it is unable to rise to the moment when the need for action, like right now, in the wake of Uvalde and Buffalo, is most acute.
If you consider yourself a supporter of the Second Amendment, you absolutely want to do something about Uvalde, to do something about murders related to domestic violence, to do something about straw purchases, to do something about teen suicide by gun.
The legislation expands criminal background checks for some gun buyers, restricts some domestic violence offenders from purchasing firearms, and funds programs that would allow gun seizures from troubled individuals. The legislation was approved on Friday by the House of Representatives and then went to President Biden for his signature. The 30-year legislation logjam on Capitol Hill was largely broken because of calls to do something after last month's massacre at that elementary school in Texas. And now the Uvalde School District's police chief, Pete Arredondo, has been placed on leave after a top official investigating the mass shooting described Arredondo's response as, quote, an abject failure. The head of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Colonel Stephen McRoss, says law enforcement arrived moments after the gunman arrived, but waited in a school hallway for nearly an hour, as shown in this just-released surveillance video, while the gunman carried out the massacre. McRoss told the Texas State Senate that Arredondo put the lives of officers ahead of children. 19 teachers and 2 students died in the shooting.
There's compelling evidence that the law enforcement response to the attack at Robb Elementary was an abject failure and antithetical to everything we've learned over the last 2 decades since the Columbine massacre. 3 minutes after the subject entered the West Building, there was a sufficient number of armed officers wearing body armor to isolate, distract, and neutralize the subject. The only thing stopping a hallway of dedicated officers from entering room 111 and 112 was the on-scene commander, who decided to place the lives of officers before the lives of children. The officers had weapons, the children had none. The officers had body armor, the children had none. The officers had training, the subject had none.
McGraw has placed a request for body cam footage with the district attorney. While McGraw places the blame on Arredondo, Uvalde Mayor Don McLaughlin blasted McGraw and DPS this week, claiming he and his city council have been kept in the dark about what evidence has been uncovered. In another development from the Uvalde City Council, the mayor announced Robb Elementary School will be demolished. Students will be relocated this fall to 2 other nearby elementary schools. The mayor said a child or teacher could never be asked to go back into that school again. This isn't the first time a school has been torn down after a massacre. Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, where 20 children and 6 adults were killed in 2012, was demolished the following year. A massive earthquake on Wednesday and an aftershock on Friday claimed more than 1,000 lives in eastern Afghanistan near the Pakistani border. Thousands more were injured. Those numbers are expected to rise dramatically. The epicenter of the 5.9 magnitude earthquake was in a mountainous region about 4 hours south of the capital city of Kabul. The powerful quake flattened stone and mud brick homes in remote mountain villages. Video footage shows desperate Afghans digging through the rubble of collapsed buildings in search of survivors. Attempts to get help to the area have been hampered by landslides that have made access on already rudimentary roadways even more difficult. The quake is the deadliest in Afghanistan in 2 decades, and international aid workers say it's compounding an already desperate situation in the country.
in Afghanistan in the last year has suffered catastrophic consequences from people losing jobs and income and drought, and farmers haven't been able to harvest. So access to food has been really tough for millions of people.
The disaster poses a major test for the Taliban-led government, which seized power nearly 10 months ago as the U.S. military and its NATO allies withdrew from the country. In a news conference, the Taliban asked for international help. But response is complicated, since many aid agencies left Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover. The European Union granted candidate status to Ukraine on Thursday. The recognition means the country is one step closer to becoming a full-fledged member of the EU. Ukraine applied for membership shortly after Russia's invasion. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called the move a victory for his country and says Ukraine's future is within the EU. This week, the CDC approved COVID-19 vaccines for children as young as 6 months, making some 20 million children eligible. Health workers began to administer the COVID-19 vaccine to children under 6 years old on Tuesday. Many parents are reluctant to sign their kids up for the vaccine. A poll from Kaiser Health found that only one in five parents will get their young children vaccinated immediately. A majority of young children have already been exposed to COVID and experienced only mild symptoms. The Food and Drug Administration has officially ordered Juul electronic cigarettes off the market. Juul has been criticized for selling sweet flavored vape pods targeted to teens. Flavored pods were banned by the FDA in 2020, but tobacco and menthol remained. The FDA said Juul's applications gave insufficient or conflicting data about the potential risks of using Juul products. When we come back, we head to the Vatican for a celebration of our faith and our families.
I'm Catherine Hadro in Rome, Italy, where the 10th World's Meeting of Families is taking place. Already delayed 1 year, this world meeting is unique from the rest. That story next.
Families are the base for the church. I mean, with Jesus Christ, of course, but I mean, the family is the base. So whatever, when we have strong families, healthy families, that's the best contribution for a healthy and a strong church.
Families as a stronghold of the faith. Thousands gather at the Vatican for the 10th World Meeting of Families. Bringing together the young and the old, every member of the family celebrated at this major event. EWTN has been providing extensive coverage of this meeting, and correspondent Catherine Hadro gives us a look at the event so far.
We're here out of gratefulness for the work that the Lord has done in our life.
This is exactly the place where Christianity can restart.
And it's true, because the Lord has so many things to give us today.
Il matrimonio non è una formalità.
Marriage is a gift, not a formality. With these words, Pope Francis kicked off the World's Meeting of Families 2022 in Rome, the heart of Catholicism. From the Pope to pop. The opera trio Il Volo performed and shared the stage with their own families.
Great joy to start off with main singers from Italy. I think it's a good start, like every World Youth Day pilgrimage as well with the youth. To start off with a concert really, I think, starts off the joy for what is to come.
With speakers and panels. Families came from across the globe to share their experience and stories. Francesco Gennarini from Rome came with his wife and 9 kids. He shares that the church helped him to live a better life, grow, and form a family.
Without the help of the church, we wouldn't be married. We wouldn't have 9 children today. A new life, not a selfish existence, which is what I was living. And today I'm grateful. This is what the church has given me. And so what can the church do? I think the Christian initiation is a great answer. And what can the families do for the church? Also participate in this work of Christian initiation, of forming small communities where people may be accompanied to having a personal encounter with Jesus Christ, which is which is joy, which is love.
This is what
Dino Fergioni and his family are missionaries in South Africa. They came to native Rome as the delegates.
At the beginning, I was a bit astonished for the fact that it was in Rome, because Rome actually is our hometown. But then I realized that re-evangelize, re-catechize the world. I can say that what the church can do for the family in the world, event like this, try to recharge.
I think the Lord is calling us, and the Pope is calling us today.
Padre.
To recharge really hard battery and to say, we are alive. The spirit is still alive. It looks like that everything is dead, that we have nothing. I always remember one of the first things that Pope Francis said, let the Lord surprise you. And it's true, because the Lord has so many things to give us today.
While this year's World Meeting of Families is much smaller than the previous nine, the schedule is still packed with presentations from Catholic speakers from across the globe. It's all focused on this year's theme, family love, a vocation, and a path to holiness. This theme of path to holiness went more in depth, focusing on married saints. It's only fitting then that the heavenly patrons of the event are Blessed Luigi and Maria Beltrame Quattrochi, the first married couple to be beatified together by the Catholic Church in the presence of their children. The couple was married right here in Rome in 1905, and three of their four children pursued and embraced the consecrated life. On Saturday evening Rome time, Pope Francis will then offer the main mass in St. Peter's Square, which will be the largest event of the meeting. And it will all conclude Sunday, when the Holy Father leads everyone in an Angelus prayer. Five jam-packed days in Rome focused on the family. Reporting from Rome, Italy, Catherine Hadro, EWTN News In Depth.
Lots of excitement at the Vatican for this major meeting. EWTN News Executive Editor and Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief Matthew Bunsen and correspondent Catherine Hadro have been providing extensive coverage of this meeting for EWTN, and they join us now to tell us more. It's so great to see you both. Looks like a beautiful, busy day for you. Matthew, you've written a biography on Pope Francis and extensive books. How is this moment at the Vatican emphatic of our Holy Father's request for Catholic families to be and do more in society?
Well, Pope Francis made it very clear when he spoke to the opening of the World Meeting of Families just the other night that we need to have what he called a feast of forgiveness, giving practical advice to all families that had gathered there, but families around the world. But one of the things that he did was to sort of put in context the often painful, difficult stories that families face, that mothers and fathers and children face. And asking the church then to provide them the tools and resources they need to strive for holiness in a very challenging world now.
And Catherine, has Pope Francis made any specific comments about the importance of family life?
Yes, well, we've heard from him once now at the Festival of Families and look forward to hearing from him two more times. But as Matthew mentioned, he really weaved in other family stories, their spiritual testimonies, and he hit on the theme of forgiveness. The line that sticks with me is forgiveness heals every wound. The reality that every family faces suffering and no family is perfect, and that's why forgiveness is vital for everyone.
Our Lord being the one that makes us whole. Matthew, can you tell me about the issues relating to motherhood and fatherhood that were addressed?
Yeah, well, we've heard from panels from all over the world, speakers who come from very different lived experiences, but who also have that universality of motherhood and fatherhood. And among the important topics, as Catherine noted, as I stressed from Pope Francis, is the idea of forgiveness, of overcoming the crises that they face. But one thing, too, that Pope Francis has focused on throughout his pontificate and that we're seeing here is hearing from the peripheries, looking for those who are forgotten, those who might be over overlooked and neglected, and then taking that into family life, looking at those peripheries. That includes, for example, the care for the elderly, the care for the unborn, especially those who might have disabilities. So we're looking at each of the dimensions of family life that we're facing today, and then sort of pulling it all together to what it means to live in a modern world, to rekindle the faith within families, but then to take it out as a missionary call into the world. It's a lot to ask of families today, and Pope Francis wants to give them as much support as possible.
He wants to be there and be close to us, like he always says. Catherine, let's talk about those peripheries with grandparents. What about them? There's been a focus of our coverage here in EWTN News In Depth with the New World Grandparents Day instituted by Pope Francis. Was there a very special message for them?
There absolutely was. There's been an ongoing theme of bringing the young and the old together. In fact, we even heard on Thursday a whole panel about that. There were practical pieces of advice about how to bring the young and the old together, cooking together, sitting together at the dinner table, and how it's so important that we hear from the elderly, that we hear from our grandparents, because they are oftentimes isolated in nursing homes, and that's the reality. As one guest put it, Pope Francis really is the Pope for grandparents. He's paid a lot of special attention to them, as you've noticed, and that's been an ongoing theme why it is vital that our generations come together, because they are so often thrown apart in this generation.
Absolutely. Matthew, you mentioned something really important about surviving trials and betrayal in family life and marriage. How has that been a focus of this?
Well, it's been a focus because we've been listening to testimonies. We've listened to panelists who have shared their life experiences. They have at times been vivid. They have been searing, is a word that I've heard a couple of times here. These are testimonies that are frank and honest. People really bearing their souls about infidelity, about enduring adultery, of seeking forgiveness for broken trust, of all of the things that can impact family life and destroy marriages. And yet the ability through the sacraments to come back into real family unity in life. One line that stayed with me throughout all of this was delivered by one of the panelists, who said that if a married couple is not ready to dive into the sacraments mm-hmm. and doctrine, they will find the winds of marriage insurmountable. And I think that's a powerful lesson delivered at times, though, with glaring, vivid, as I said, testimonials of pain and brokenness.
An important moment of frankness for us in our church. Thank you both for this extensive coverage. We're looking forward to being with you, and we pray for you throughout the weekend.
One of the things that people have asked us a lot over the years is how do we stay in business?
A family-run Catholic bookstore shares its secret sauce, why customers keep coming back year after year, when we return.
Many of us already know that shopping can be a form of recreation. Well, it can also be a form of spiritual inspiration. That's part of the secret of success at a well-known Catholic bookstore with a firm foothold in the middle of the Bible Belt. Reporter Mark Irons takes us to Nashville, Tennessee.
Country music, packed honky-tonks, and neon nightlife capture most of the attention in downtown Nashville. But there's something about this modest storefront with simple blue lettering that has drawn people inside for many, many years.
I think it's an icon in itself.
This longtime customer has been visiting St. Mary's for decades.
Nashville, Tennessee isn't a place you would instantly associate with the Catholic faith, but right in the heart of town, a thriving Catholic bookstore.
The sign outside tells you St. Mary's is more than a bookstore.
I think people who have faith or of faith come here for many reasons.
In business since the 1940s, St. Mary's was first owned by the Diocese of Nashville, then handed off to a devout Catholic family in the late 70s.
The bishop called my mom and asked if she was interested in running it.
Now Julie Cragen and her husband Alan continue the family business here on West End Avenue.
It was an apartment building originally, and they were able to renovate it to use more like a retail store.
St. Mary's bookstore is four floors packed with faith.
We have stuff everywhere in this building.
Crucifixes, rosaries, religious medals, calendars, cards, statues, and of course,
we sell a lot of books.
And they sell all kinds of church supplies. The buyers include Catholic as well as Protestant churches. Alan keeps in touch with regional houses of worship and delivers the goods himself.
It's sort of old school way of doing business in a way, but it's good.
And maybe it's that personal touch that has people coming back. After all, how does a Catholic bookstore do so well for so many years in the middle of the Bible Belt?
We cater to a lot of non-Catholic churches as well as individuals. I think they feel at home here. You know, they know us and you know, we love each other equally.
Things gradually go and leave. And I'm hopeful that this never leaves.
St. Mary's seems to have staying power. A Baptist bookstore and a Methodist bookstore were in business nearby for a time.
Both of them have now shut down their stores, and it's amazing. We have seen an uptick in customers coming in who've never been in here before. As one lady told me, she says, they want me to order online. She says, I like to stop in and pick up things.
St. Mary's has an online presence as well, but this simple brick and mortar with the creaky wood floors and home-like feel keeps attracting people off the noisy street, including this first-time visitor from Colorado.
From outside, it looks like a very modest store with really nice window displays. And you step in and it just is much bigger inside. It's magical. I mean, it really is kind of a treasure what's here.
People of faith and no faith wander in, and Julie Cragen says over the years, plenty of inspiring stories have come back out.
We have people say to us, you know, St. Mary's had a part in me coming to the Catholic faith, or, you know, me becoming a priest, or me raising my children, coming back to the church.
Turns out the sign outside says it right. St. Mary's is more than a bookstore.
Even without us trying, it's a place for people to feel at home in their faith and in their love for Jesus Christ.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
And finally today, back to the World Meeting of Families, where young, old, all generations of the family took part in the opening ceremony on Wednesday. Those tender moments between mother and child, our Holy Father and toddlers, and beautiful music come together in our Images of the Week.
Benvenuti al festival che apre il decimo incontro mondiale delle famiglie.
Every time I close my eyes, the thought of you is everywhere inside my mind. I hear your voice, can't sleep, it keeps me up at night. And I want you always. You breathe life inside me, give me air and hope, a reason to believe. I want the world to know every single thing about this grand amour.
Ogni vostra famiglia ha una missione da compiere nel mondo, una testimonianza da dare.
And that's a wrap on this week's edition of EWTN News in Depth. Next week, more analysis and details on the big decisions at the Supreme Court impacting religion and your Catholic life. We'll be joined by leading attorneys who argued those cases before the justices. Join us for their fascinating insights. I'm Montse Alvarado. We'll see you same time next week.